Welcome to the Surviving Grief Podcast, hosted by our grief ministry leaders at Crossroads Church. We'll be sitting down with friends as they share their powerful stories of loss and healing, and we'll hear from grief professionals and other wise people with useful tools for our own time of grief. If you're supporting someone who's grieving, you'll learn how to comfort them and walk with them on their own path to healing. Let's join the conversation.
Welcome to another episode of Surviving Grief. I'm your host for today, Meg Skelfgott, and this is episode 2 of a book study that we are going through called Anxiety, The Missing Stage of Grief, a revolutionary approach to understanding and healing the impact of loss. The author is Claire Bidwell Smith, and if you didn't get all that, don't worry. In the show notes. You can just click on down and we'll have a list of the title. And so as we get into this second episode, we're going to spend some time on her chapter 8 and 9, which really touches on this idea of the brain. So my background within brain, so I did not come from a doctor standpoint, but really a hands-on standpoint. So my husband and I have Activate Brain and Body here in Cincinnati and Indianapolis, but over the last probably 5 years, I've been entrenched in this world of understanding the brain, and specifically around grief and healing, and really, like, how do we get the most out of our operating system? And through the context of grief, you know, I think of the brain, when we're in that state of grieving, much like a storm, all right? So when a storm comes over the ocean, right, it's just going to stir things up. So in this case, grief is stirring the brain's emotional centers. It's creating waves of anxiety and sadness, confusion, to put it mildly. So over time, the storm calms and the waters settle. But before we get to all those calm seas, we gotta deal with the churning that's happening. So that may be where you find yourself today. You have the churning, whether you feel depressed, whether you have anxiety. In the previous episode, we spent a lot of time kind of talking about the black and white of anxiety. What are the physical symptoms? What are the manifestations? What are some of the emotional symptoms that pop up? And so today, we want to take a practical look at what Claire recommends around some really important knowledge and skills of, one, understanding what's happening in the brain, but then also, what do we do with that? And so, again, this is going to be going through chapters 8 and 9 within the book. But one thing that I do want to kind of bring your attention to is that she starts off by, when she's looking at this lens of the brain, that she wants this to be a way to not only identify your anxiety, but again, how are you seeing the world through that lens? We've already talked about that grief really transforms us. And so part of that transformation is also how we see the world. Right? In grief, the brain's clarity is like looking through a foggy window. It's hard to see clearly because of all the things that we are experiencing. And so Claire really takes an impressive look at, okay, this is what the reality of what you're dealing with. Now, how do we sort through it? So she starts off by talking about how to harness your anxious thoughts. And the most valuable tool that you can acquire in that process of gaining control is to relinquish your anxiety. Now, we've already talked about that grief is just going to exacerbate anxiety. So if you were someone who was anxious before you experienced loss, chances are it is amplified. However, if this is brand new to you, as it was for me when I first started experiencing anxiety after the loss of my sister, one thing that I was really startled by is just, I didn't even know it was anxiety. For me, it showed up as anger. It showed up as restlessness, fatigue, things like that. That it took months before I could really appreciate, oh, I'm anxious. Oh, I'm not firing on all cylinders. You know, something as benign as saying foggy brain. I just thought I was really forgetful. I didn't realize that that was actually tied to anything. So Claire starts off by walking us through the cognitive behavioral therapy. Now, she refers to this as CBT, And if this is the first time that you're hearing about this, it's a really interesting type of study that's not only just directly going to address the grief process, but it very much works on working to alleviate and eliminate anxious thoughts that come as a result of loss. So CBT is really kind of looking at a short-term goal-oriented treatment that uses practical approach to change thought patterns, behaviors, things like that, that really are going to impact a person's emotional well-being. And so as she kind of brings in some other doctors to talk about these types of therapies, I want to emphasize that the core of CBT addresses the idea that the way that we think directly affects how we feel. So changing the way that we think can help change how we feel. And again, this is a secular book, but looking at this through a Christian lens for a second, this idea of renewing our minds, I don't think it's talked about enough in the context of grief. Just because we show up one way doesn't mean that's how we need to continue moving forward. And so when we think about anxiety and how do we invite God into that process, I like to really take a moment to evaluate, like, what does God have for me? When you are dealing with loss, everything is upside down. Everything is upside down. So this idea that what God has for us as being his best, that may not even factor in. You're like, I'm just trying to get through the day. I am just trying to get to my next breath. You know, and so grief really distorts what God has for us, including how we handle the day-to-day stress that comes with us. Romans 12:2, do not conform to the patterns of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. What does that look like to renew our minds? When I first started suffering from anxiety, and I want to be clear, this was never something that I met with a professional for. This was never something that I felt like I needed medication for. But it was still really disruptive to my life in terms of temperament. The anger for me is usually what I reference the most because it was the most visible professionally, personally. I was just running on a short fuse. And then the anxiety was really tied to concern for other people, concern for loved ones in my life. Because at its core, again, anxiety is fear. And so I had no control when I lost my sister. And so now I'm trying to exert control wherever I can. So the brain is very temperamental in that it likes habits. It likes routines. And it doesn't take all that long to create new patterns, but it takes even longer, usually triple the time, to unlearn those habits. And so as we look at how to renew your mind, not only in a spiritual sense, but also in the practical logistical sense, these things take time. And much like we covered in the first episode, grace and healing is a powerful thing. I yelled at people that I probably shouldn't have. I had to go back most of the time. I'm sure there's plenty of people I yelled at in the throes of grief that I never apologized to. But grace covers those things. And part of the deepening in my faith is that anxiety took me to a place that felt a lot like rock bottom. It felt a lot like hopelessness. And I want this chapter and this portion of the book covering the brain to really encourage you that no matter how difficult things feel right now, and I get it, I get that it feels difficult. I get that, especially if you are in the throes of anxiety all the time, that is a hard place to exist. It can feel like a hopeless place to exist, but God does have better for us. Many of the thoughts that occur after a significant loss are new ones, okay? Maybe you suddenly have fears of other people around you passing away, and that was never something that was top of mind previously. But even if these aren't new to you, they can still be something that helps us identify within ourselves where are we trying to cling to control in ways that we should really give that back to God. So let's go back and talk about this cognitive behavioral therapy, so the CBT. So she does a really amazing job of, you know, in previous chapters, she has given you lists and kind of these, the best way to check in with yourself and evaluate things. And so she starts off with a really great two-column list that has anxiety state and then the underlying fear. So under anxiety state, she encourages people to list various things that make you anxious. So this can be that work event, that thing that you need to go to. It can be a specific situation or a specific time. But the underlying fear is the second column. So that's where you would name the specific fear, the threat, or the catastrophe behind each anxiety. So for me, it was the specific state. Let's say it was going to a work party. So that would be the anxiety state that I was kind of anticipating. But the underlying fear is people asking about my sister, or even not asking about my sister, and me crying on the spot, or me getting angry on the spot. And so what this allows you to go through on this kind of a little bit of workshopping is starting to pull the thread and make the anxiety more manageable. Much like just the term grief, these are giant big feelings. And when we give ourselves kind of the mental space to pull the thread, to peel back the onion, then we can understand what specifically am I concerned about? Anxiety, it's a really complicated creature. And we already know that it's, you know, it affects us both physically and mentally, emotionally, spiritually. But just from a physical symptom standpoint, when you go through this list, this anxiety state, and then what's the underlying fear, already you will most likely trigger some physical symptoms: chest pressure, tightness of breath, elevated heart rate. So these are our fight or flight symptoms that automatically turn on. And we cover this a little bit in week one, but if those are happening, that's actually a good thing. It means your body is doing what it's supposed to do. These are warning bells that, hey, something is not right. But the key here is we are going to then reframe those anxiety-producing moments to better understand, okay, I'm afraid of this, or I have anxiety about this, but is the threat real? And that's how we start to manage some of those physical symptoms. Now, within the context of the anxiety state, again, so we're going to take that core event, what are some of the cognitive symptoms that are going to arise as we think about it? So, fear of death or a physical impairment, fear of being unable to cope, fear of going crazy. These are all just examples of the cognitive symptoms that can start to bubble up. Perceptions of, you know, unreality, things that do not align with your reality. And so as a result, we become hyper-vigilant in the process. She also goes through the behavioral symptoms. So much like the cognitive systems, these are going to be avoidance of the situation altogether, right? So you stop calling people, you stop going to places that you would normally do. Things like escape plans. So you walk into the room and you start thinking about, okay, where are the doors? How do I get out? And you might even feel that way even in a car. If you lost someone in a car accident, suddenly you're not taking roads that you would normally take, or you don't take the highways in a way that they took. That's something that in previous grief groups, especially with parents who have lost a child from a car accident of some kind, that's something that I hear pretty routinely about where they will and will not drive. If they have other kids, they don't want their kids to drive places, things like that. And that also ties back to the hypervigilance from the cognitive symptoms as well. Trouble speaking, even just agitation. These are all behavioral symptoms that follow the cognitive symptoms. The emotional symptoms that arise as a result of both the cognitive and the behavioral symptoms, they're going to be hand in hand. So I want you to think of these as best buddies. And that's not necessarily good for us, but they are hand in hand in terms of how they relate to each other. So if you're feeling scared or even terrified, then you're going to see more of those behavioral symptoms, right? If you're feeling edgy or jumpy, you're going to feel more of those symptoms because the cognitive and the behavioral are so tied together. So based on those lists, right, based on this anxiety state and then the underlying fear, once you have those, then you can move on to pulling that thread a little further. And so she breaks it down even more with an additional list. And again, I would recommend looking at the book to see kind of more of the charts that she creates. But she creates a four-pillar chart, on what are your anxious thoughts, what are the physical symptoms, what are the cognitive symptoms, what are the behavioral symptoms. And so once you have that individual event and you understand what the core fear is, then you're simply just working through, how is this showing up for me? So much of grief and also anxiety is giving name to our experience, and it's taking those big feelings and it's making it more manageable. When we're suffering from anxiety, we have a tendency to exaggerate and even catastrophize the possibility of bad outcomes. And this can range from a strange mole that, let's say, you find on your arm. Suddenly you're like, this is cancer, this is the end, I have to go see someone right now. And so, you know, you cancel everything you had that day and you're trying to get in urgently into doctor's appointments when it may not necessarily even be a risk, but our response to it is so big. But you're not alone if that's your experience, right? If these catastrophic responses are kind of your go-to, that's just a coping mechanism. So earlier in the book, Claire talked about how highly anxious people sometimes have a tendency to remain in that hypervigilant state. So that's where they're on guard, right, for everything, whether it's physical or emotional. They're checking in with loved ones. You know, however bereavement is striking them, hypervigilance usually follows in a similar way, right? If they had a family member who passed away from a health issue, they tend to be more tied into their remaining family or even themselves on, okay, am I okay? Do I need to go to a doctor? Things like that. And so what the studies have shown is that anxious thinking happens in less than half a second. So we don't have this big runway where these neural pathways are, you know, they're taking 20 minutes from you see the mole to then you have a meltdown about what is this. And so in that split second, that's where the habits are that we can retrain and we can rewire the brain, which is actually a really incredible gift that I think that God just automatically builds into our bodies to help encourage us that, again, we have systems, they are working for us. And that's a good thing, right? We just have to understand how to reboot the systems a little bit. And also, like, having faith and having hope that what you're experiencing is not how things need to stay. Psalm 23:4, even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. And that might sound like something that's trite in the moment, but the truth of that, the eternal truth of that, remains the same, is that whatever you're going through, whatever the panic, whatever the fear that's kind of right on top of your chest that makes it tough to breathe, that you're not forsaken in that moment. And even just inviting God into that process in the moment, you know, depending on what your faith is, it can be in the car before you have to go into this event that you're so anxious about, just saying, God, I need help. It can be that simple of just inviting God into the process. Okay, so this catastrophic thinking that so many of us have struggled with in the throes of anxiety is just a way for us to cope. Ultimately, how do we cope with the disaster and the fallout that we're living through? And so the best way is to study your responses. And so that's why Claire gives these worksheets to help you ask better questions. When we label ourselves as depressed or as anxious, you know, there's power in words. And so when we lead with that, there's an expectation that that's just who I am. And also that's what my responses need to be. In episode one of this book study, we talked a lot about how anxiety can be addictive because there's a sense of control there. And so it's not about us controlling the situation by, you know, choosing to have fear about these things, but we're giving it back to God in the process. And so her kind of work through charts around catastrophic thinking, she has you describe what actually made you anxious about the situation. How do you imagine coping in the situation? And how would you like to cope? You know, so many times with anxiety, part of this, I think, is cultural as well. We lead with it. We lead with the things that we are anxious about. We talk about them a lot. And what happens is that tape that we're playing, whether we're sharing it with other people or just to ourselves, we kind of get caught in that negative loop. And the thing about negative thought patterns, and very much those anxious thought patterns, is they just spur more anxious thinking. And so from a brain rewiring standpoint, we have to break the habit. So how do we break the habit? By doing something that we don't typically do. So first, we need to stop the behavior. And that's a full stop, something that's going to completely break the pattern. So let's use the context of you're going to a family event that's very stressful, right? There's family dynamics. Maybe there's, you know, a conversation about your loved one that's going to be coming up. And you just feel anxious. And, you know, as you're listening to this, you're like, I don't think I have catastrophic thinking about this. I don't, you know, but it's pulling the thread of what are my patterns and then how do I change it? So understanding the fear of anxiety. So often in grief group, what we hear people talk about with grief and specifically the anxiety around it is this is how things will always be. This is how things will always be. But understanding that your brain is a GPS, right? And so we need to do a little bit of rerouting and you taking care of you. And so part of that has to do with how do we lift the fog and put ourselves in new situations to really breathe life and restoration into our minds as well. So anxious thoughts. So we're existing in anxiety. We want things to get better. What do we do now? What do we do now? We don't want to live in this place. We want things to improve. We want things to get better. And that's why I love the idea of seeing our brain in the course of grief as a storm over the ocean, because there is churning and there are waves and there's things capsizing. And yet it doesn't stay there. Eventually the sun comes out, even at the darkest points in the storm. And just like our emotional centers will settle down, much like the waves, these are all things that need time. But we got to cope in the middle. So let's talk about strategies. So first, we're going to go through some of her recommendations. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of my experiences as well. And really the top cognitive rewiring strategies that I recommend to people. So the first thing that Claire really recommends is, you know, it's normal. We started off by talking about grace and understanding that anxiety is a part of the grieving process. You are not crazy. You are someone who is grieving. And I think that there can be a lot of encouragement in that, knowing that you are not the only person who is experiencing anxiety coming off of a loss. Your grief journey is unique to you, and yet there are hallmarks. Much of the anxiety is something that a lot of people can understand, and that's why there's so much power in simply being in community. And also, you know, anxiety, remember, it's not only is it normal, but it helps prepare us for other things, right? That job interview you have, or that, you know, that event that you're hosting. Anxiety can be helpful in really sharpening our skills and our tools, but we just need to do a better job of tempering it, right? So that it's not taking over our lives and that we're still able to operate within it. She also talks about catching your anxious thoughts. So fearful thoughts can occur automatically. We talked about, you know, less than a second between that catastrophic thinking kicking in. Gather the evidence. So this is the reframing that needs to happen. When you gather evidence, you have a better understanding of, is my perception reality? And that can be a hard question to ask if you're unfamiliar with how to reframe. But that's why her worksheets and some of those charts that she recommended could be really helpful tools, because we have to hit pause in the moment, which I know can be really hard when you feel all of those physical symptoms starting, the elevated heart rate, the breathing, things like that. You take a pause and say, okay, is what I'm thinking based on the reality of the situation? And that takes a lot of self-control. She recommends creating a cost-benefit analysis, embracing the catastrophe, and really kind of working through what are the solutions. And ultimately, we want to take a solution-based approach. With anxiety and some of the labels that I think get a little bit glorified of, you know, we lead in introductions, right? We'll say our name and say, oh, I'm socially anxious, you know, things like that. It's putting those to the side and then understanding, how can I better assess the situation from a solution? I don't want to live in this place. I want things to improve. And in order to improve, I need to take a breath and I need to better evaluate, okay, How can I be creative, resourceful, and whole in this moment? And of course, you know, praying. What, you know, this is not a Christian book. I would put prayer as the top of the list of things that I recommend, even in the moment of just inviting God into these opportunities that we feel stressed. So the second half of her kind of the brain chapter has a lot to do around awareness, but then also the strategies. So she talks about deep breathing, progressive muscle relaxation. So deep breathing is something that I don't think gets nearly the fanfare that it should. So if you've ever seen someone who's upset and then, you know, someone from the peanut gallery is like, just take a breath. You know, that doesn't typically calm people down just saying that. If anything, it could probably fan the flames a little bit. But there is truth to take a breath. We talked earlier about some of these physical body systems that kick on with our fight or flight. But stress is what the key is here. You're feeling stress, you're feeling fear, and then all of these alarm systems start turning on, starting with your blood pressure. Your face might be getting flushed, things like that. And as that breath work, or as your breathing kind of starts to become erratic and other things within that fight or flight system turn on, that's when we typically don't evaluate our surroundings at our best. So life happens. We get it, right? It can be difficult all day. It can be difficult for a moment. But breathing allows us to dump that carbon dioxide and start to turn off some of those systems in a hurry. And so the way to do that is to increase your oxygen intake. And so she walks you through a handful of breathing techniques. So she is a big fan of diaphragm breathing. She talks about the progressive muscle relaxation. In all of these, the goal is more inhales, longer exhales. That's the key for these. So her diaphragm breathing, she does a really good job of kind of breaking through some of the application pieces. So she talks about, you know, you're sitting comfortably or you're lying down, you're breathing in slowly through your nose so that your stomach moves out against your hand, and then you're getting a big exhale through the mouth. And so she's recommending anywhere between 5 to 20 minutes of this. If you are someone who is in the throes of a panic attack, you cannot just go lay down and, you know, think of all the things that you're grateful for. In you know, on paper, that might look like, okay, that's plausible. But we know that when you're in the middle of a meeting and you can feel all those stress systems turning on, how do you deal with it? I am a huge, huge fan of Huberman Labs, who talks about the physiological sigh. This is the fastest way to dump carbon dioxide from your system. So if you are unfamiliar with this technique, this is a really simple inhale through the nose, pause, second inhale through the nose, big exhale through the mouth. And it only takes about 2 to 3 times to really empty out all of that carbon dioxide. So the reason that this is such a great tool is because this is something that you automatically do in deep sleep. If you've ever seen a dog sleeping, they do this all the time. If you've ever seen a crying toddler, they do that when you hear that double inhale. And so again, it's the fastest way to start to shut off some of those stress responses. The other thing is that it triggers the neurons in your brain to start firing differently. So again, double inhale. So inhale through the nose, pause, second inhale through the nose, and then a big exhale through the mouth. She also talks a little bit about the Byron Katie 4 questions. So this is just something that's more of like a self inquiry than it is a breathing technique, but it's 4 questions that I think are wildly helpful in the moment when we're seeing red or we're starting to panic. First, is it true? Yes or no? Is it true? Is my evaluation of what I'm seeing, of what I'm experiencing, is it true? Yes or no? So if it's no, you move on to number 3. If it's yes, you move on to number 2. Can you absolutely know that it is true? Yes or no? 3, how do you react? What happens when you believe that thought? And then 4, who would you be without that thought? So what I like about these assessment questions is she really does an interesting job of helping you in the moment pull the thread, right? So why do I think this? Why are these like my responses? And you know, this entire chapter is just giving you more tools to better evaluate how we see the world in the throes of anxiety and really kind of allowing some of these check-ins as well. The last thing that I would say about the brain where anxiety and grief are concerned. Grief transforms more than just our perception of the world, of our perception of self, of our perception of the Lord. What it does is it really shakes a fundamental view of how we experience life. And so I think anxiety really speaks a lot of lies to us about how we are meant to live. And, you know, God does not want us white knuckling through life. He, you know, pain and joy can coexist. And the fear of future loss, gosh, it is just a weight around our neck if we choose to exist in that place. Losing a loved one absolutely increases our anxiety, right? We have this heightened worry, this existential anxiety. But God can meet us in that place and he can minister to us through community, through his word. I mean, there's just, it's an opportunity to really grow with him because it can just feel so hard. It can feel so suffocating. So I would really encourage you to lean into the word if this is something that you're struggling with. You know, in Matthew 11:28, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Anxiety doesn't allow us to rest. Anxiety keeps us on alert, ready to run, ready to fight at all times. Bring it to the Lord. Find rest. We have one more episode of going through anxiety, the missing stage of grief. I hope that you'll join us for it. Thanks.
Surviving Grief is a production of Crossroads Church, Cincinnati, Ohio. If you'd like to connect or share your own story, reach out to us at podcasts@crossroads.net. That's podcasts with an S at crossroads.net. We'll see you next time.